It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story about a mythical lumberjack and his ox.
We recently received a Wisconsin question from Ryan Urban of Rice Lake. He had a few questions about Paul Bunyan. Was he based on a real person? Did the tall tale begin in Wisconsin? And why is this legend still so popular? WPR's Jenny Peek set out to learn more about this flannel-wearing Northwoods lumberjack.
A job that needed a great big man, Paul Bunyan was the one.
Paul Bunyan stories are plentiful. He cleared forests with one swing of his axe. He and his trusty bovine, Babe the Blue Ox, dug the Great Lakes just to quench the thirst of his fellow loggers. He created the Mississippi River by simply dragging his axe behind him. He's a Wisconsin folk hero. But why? That's what Ryan Urban of Rice Lake wanted to know.
It's hard to travel around northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, Michigan for that matter, without seeing something Paul Bunyan related. And I guess I started to ask myself why.
I spoke with Michael Edmonds, a historian who researched and wrote the preeminent book on Paul Bunyan.
Paul Bunyan was for decades in the last century the best known American folk hero. He was Thor. He was Ulysses. The first mention of Paul Bunyan's story being told dates to the winter of 1885-1886 in the town of Tomahawk.
Edmund says the stories began as an oral tradition, passed down by loggers until the start of World War I in 1914.
In that oral tradition, Bunyan is one of the guys. He's a lumberjack. He might be a crew leader, but he's a tough working class guy. He's not very bright. He doesn't know how to read and write. But he's very, very strong, of course, very, very large, can solve many problems with brute strength.
Fast forward to 1915, the Red River Lumber Company in Minneapolis began an advertising campaign capitalizing on Paul Bunyan's popularity. The company shared the lumberjack stories in a catalog that was mailed to lumberyards across the United States.
And so Bunyan escaped the woods into the lumber industry as a whole. And the Red River Lumber Company was brilliant because, like the Grateful Dead, they allowed people to reproduce their products. They did not copyright these stories. And so they were seized upon by other publishers.
But as Paul Bunyan's stories transitioned from oral tellings to print, the tales changed.
When they were told out loud, it was lumberjacks trying to tease or fool one another. When they hit print, the audience was middle-class people who buy books. And in the end, by the 1950s, they only survive as children's books.
With my double-blade axe and my hobnail boots, I go where the timber's tall. When there's work to be done, don't mess around, just sing right up or call.
And the tales are just that, stories. Edmund says there never was a real Paul Bunyan or Babe the Blue Ox.
There is no good evidence that there was anyone like Paul Bunyan. We want to believe in someone who can solve our problems, who's more powerful than we are as we face the challenges of life. And that was true for lumberjacks in the Wisconsin Northwoods in the 1880s and 90s, just like it's true for us today.
As for where Paul Bunyan hails from, well, that's here, in the Northwoods of Wisconsin.
Many, many states have claimed to be the birthplace of Paul Bunyan, but the only evidence that I could find places his birth, so to speak, not in Minnesota, but in north central Wisconsin. You know, this was nostalgia. This was an idealized, mythical frontier like the one they recalled from their childhoods. So 1915 to 1960, maybe, it's really easy to understand why the stories were popular. After that, I don't know.
Reasoning aside, it seems Paul Bunyan is here to stay, along with the rivers, lakes, and hills he's said to have created.
WPR's Jenny Peek brought us that story on Paul Bunyan. And the story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We get analysis now on the new FBI report on hate crime statistics in America and what it means as thousands of police departments did not submit this data to the federal report. Call in about hate crime incidents, how to prevent them, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Levin is a criminal justice professor, directs the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. I love being on WPR. And by the way, just so I don't get in trouble, I also love being on the folks across the border at Minnesota Public Radio. They always get into detail. So thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate that. Well, let's dig in then to this new FBI report suggesting hate crimes are declining nationally. The report shows a 12% reduction last year from the previous year. What is your reaction to these numbers?
Yikes. let me just make it real simple. They left out nearly all of California and New York City. So if you just include those, just bear with me, you have about 9,500. Just from those two jurisdictions alone, the record was 9,730 in 2001. So this report, I've spoken to folks, including in the government, about it, is not representative of what's actually happening. So it's incredibly annoying and frustrating, particularly for also terrorized communities. Can I give you a quick thing on
yes,
that?
Yes, sure.
So, by the way, interestingly enough, Wisconsin showed an increase, but they showed a significant decrease of over 100 agencies. In 2020, over 440 of 448 law enforcement agencies in Wisconsin reported hate crimes, but it dropped down to 325. So anyway, over 100, but Wisconsin still went up. But what I think we have, frankly, is a probable record for hate crimes in 2021, if not almost up there. Because when we just add New York and California, we are already up to the mid 9,000s, and the highest, as I said, was 9,700. But if we look at certain communities, for instance, anti-Asians showed an increase to 305. But we looked at major cities, many of them that were excluded, and we found 369, which would break a record just in those 21 cities. So bottom line is, and what the folks from the FBI told us, is that those that have reported are showing an increase. And I've asked the FBI to amend their report, and they seem, I think, positive to doing that. But it's the most incomplete report we probably had in the three decades of counting this stuff. And we went from 93% participation. Of course, many of those that participate just send a form and it says zero. 93% to just under 65%. And the kinds of places that we're not getting are the highest reporting places, like California, like New York City. Listen to this, New York City, Chicago, and L.A.,
biggest cities.
Zero, right. Yeah.
So
zero or didn't show up.
So naturally, we asked why. Why are there such big holes in this reporting?
There's a good reason for it, but I think they were administratively required to release the report incomplete. And about a month ago, Director Ray warned us during testimony before the Senate that it would be incomplete. Why? Great question. You're switching from an older system under the Uniform Crime Reports, which go back to the early 1930s. They're now switching to a really well-done computer platform that's going to count more crimes and have more information about these events. Unfortunately, this transition has been extraordinarily bumpy. But the good news is for 2022, there's much greater compliance. But what it did is like a strike-shortened baseball season. In other words, you're not getting the full amount.
But is the data useful even with its flaws? Are there some key observations you can extract given that you just don't have the compliance of the numbers in these major cities?
Yes, there's a lot of things we can find even from limited data because it's a national sample. But what you can't get are trends, right? You know, it's like leaving the Badgers out of the football stuff. You can't do it. So what we can get is information about weapon use, about age of offenders, and what are the worst days for hate crime. So some of the things that we did, for instance, we found in our own research that hate crimes against Jews, for instance, rose in May during the Gaza war. And we found that to be true even with those limitations. But for getting trends, forget it. It is not going to be usable. But what we hope to do, and what I believe the FBI will try to do based on conversations, is that they're going to try and amend it later on. At least it seems that they're open to it. But, yeah, you can't get any kind of trend because we're showing a decline when we're actually probably breaking a record or darn close to it. We've only had one time where hate crimes were over 9,000, and that was in 2001 around the 9/11 attacks. So the American public is not getting the full picture that, for instance, our research has done. Just real briefly, here's what it showed. We had two data sets, one of over 50 cities, including 35 of the top ones, population-wise. And they tend to be more diverse and less white. Whites are actually a minority. And what we found was a 29% increase across that whole set of over 50. But the top 10 cities, which were all a million or more, had a 39% increase. One last thing, though, when we looked at states, we looked at about 20 states in D.C., it was a 21% increase. So we're probably talking somewhere in that range, maybe from the upper teens to the mid-20% increase, and either close to a record or a probable record when we add in reliable agencies just like California and New York City, which were excluded this year.
Why is reporting hate crimes, why for law enforcement is that voluntary? About half of states don't require hate crime reporting. What is going on there with why it's voluntary?
That's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it. What we propose is to make it mandatory in some way, but throw a carrot in there, and that is, you know, like, for instance, in Florida, their top cities, Miami, last decade reported 0 8 out of 10 years. And this year they only reported 1 for the whole state. So mandatory, I think, would be good, particularly if it's tied to a carrot approach. In other words, maybe withhold some funding and say, but if you have a model policy, if you're making an effort in outreach, if you can at least show some deliverables that we know impact reporting. One other quick thing that I think would be beneficial. I think states should have commissions on the state of hate like we did in California. And while I'm a commissioner, I'm just speaking as director of the center. But I think Wisconsin would be well served to do that. And can I just say one other quick thing about one of my favorite states? There is someone in Wisconsin who is stalking me, and his name is Masood Akhtar, and he founded We Are Many United Against Hate. When I say stalking me in a loving way.
In a very good way, I want to point out, yes.
And he was recognized at the White House for being a uniter. So there are things that folks can do, and I think We Are Many United Against Hate Wisconsin. Go Google it. They're such a wonderful group, and I'm privileged to be on the board. But whenever I go on somewhere, he says, why don't you mention it? And I said, you need an acronym. It's too long.
Well, the kudos nonetheless are amazing. We have the head of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, Brian Levin at California State University, San Bernardino. Join in on hate crimes reporting data, how this hits home to you, what can be done to effectively stop hate crimes in our country, what works? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We focus on rising hate crimes and how to interpret this trend in America with an eye on Wisconsin. Join in on the perspective of law enforcement, how to better investigate and track these crimes, your personal stories, connection to hate crimes and their aftermath. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. We have criminal justice professor Brian Levin, who directs the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Let's look at the continuum, Brian. Your center studied FBI hate crime reports from 91 to 2020, and you looked at it comparing major events in America, like the attacks on 9/11. What did you find?
Wow, and what a great question. What we found was, in the past, catalytic incidents like a terror attack or some conflict would result in spikes, for instance. And the worst days were generally around the 9/11 attacks. But we found something more recently in 2020. Just bear with me. Particularly with the time of a couple of things. One, the rise of COVID hospitalizations, but also the rise of anti-Asian invective, which led to a real big increase, and then it kind of went down a little bit, and then it went up again in 2021. So we saw this really terrible carouseling where, like, when the eye of the hurricane comes and you think you're safe, you're not. And what we saw in the summer of 2020 was something really interesting. We went from anti-Asian hate crimes rising in the spring to in June having the worst month for anti-Black hate crime. And that that extended through the summer. So what happened was, like in the past, a catalytic event would result in a spike. But now there's this kind of prism online that keeps these stereotypes and conspiracy theories prominent for longer. So we saw the N-word spike at the same time, and it spiked for longer online, and we also saw a hate crime spike. The other interesting thing that we're seeing is, while we certainly see groups that get carouseled in, we're seeing these increases be more sticky. They're staying up longer, and I think that's correlated to how much this stuff stays amplified online. And one more quick thing. Not only does it stay amplified, but even when it goes back down, there's now an archive which can be sparked anytime. So bottom line, we're seeing increases that still go up, but they stay higher for longer. So after 9/11, overall hate crime, not against Muslims and Arabs, but overall hate crime, it took a month to go down. In 2020, it took multiple months for us to revert back to that pre-catalytic level.
Social media there, certainly a difference. Let's bring in a call now, Kevin in Janesville. Kevin, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, as a middle school teacher, I see the patterns of hate and aggression already well entrenched. Obviously, virtually no one is born to hate. It's taught, it's learned, and it's being learned at a very young age and encouraged. I hate to wish more on my teacher colleagues, but what more can we do as a society, as a profession? What can we do to help nip this before the patterns of hate are learned?
So how to unlearn hate. Kevin, thank you. Brian?
I think we need to hire a million Kevins to teach. And what I mean is, yes, we have high influencers. And interestingly enough, what we see online is a relatively small number of high influencers. When I say high influencers, people with a lot of notoriety or a lot of followers, taking conspiracy theories and stereotypes and elevating them. So soccer coaches, and more importantly, the school teachers, they are in a unique position, because one of the things we know about hate or prejudice is there's three parts. One is how the information comes in, cognition. The other is the emotional response. And the third is behavior. And teachers are among the most beloved folks, even though we take a hit, in our community. So what I'm saying to you is, it's the teachers, the soccer coach, the interfaith people, the We Are Many United Against Hate folks. Get together with the resources that you have, both locally and also nationally. There are a variety of excellent curricula out there. The other thing that I would say, and a good friend of mine, Dr. Cynthia Miller Idris, who is actually an education professor as well, talks about teaching certain critical thinking skills. In other words, don't let your emotions take over. Let's look at some facts and teach critical thinking skills, particularly when people are on the internet. And this kind of stuff is everywhere. So educators like Kevin are local heroes. And we have to remember that folks like the scout leaders, the teachers, the soccer coaches, in how they lead, and even in instances that are teachable moments, can really make a difference, along with teaching people that not every, young people, that not everything you see online is true, and how to kind of fact check. That's part of teaching for civics today, is trying to inoculate folks from the toxins that are online.
We have less than a minute left, Brian, but what is your focus on now in the center as you try to see what the FBI is doing and in terms of their own new system of reporting? How do you make your adjustments going forward with research?
Well, what we have to do is call for the FBI, as we have it. We had very productive discussions with them about amending this report, and they'll get that information. But I do think that this particular year was a one-off with regard to that transition. But we still have structural problems with regard to many states reporting hardly any, when we have other even moderate-sized cities reporting more hate crimes in many whole states.
Mm. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your research.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the wonderful job that you do at Wisconsin Public Radio. I love being on your network.
Mm. Brian Levin is director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, and a criminal justice professor. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.